Wednesday, October 9th. Good afternoon. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I am Avi Wolfman Arendt. You're listening to Studio 2 from WHYY. Today, Cherry, would have been John Lennon's 84th birthday.
Wow.
And as a birthday tribute to him, let me read one of his lyrics to you. Drove from Paris to the Amsterdam Hilton, talking in our beds for a week. The news people, that's us, said, "Say, what you doing in bed?" I said, "We're only trying to get us some peace." The bed, the couch, your house, it can be a regenerative place,
yes,
Cherry.
I like all those places.
But how much is too much when it comes to staying home? Americans are spending more and more of their time at home, Cherry, according to a new study by one of our guests today in the second and third segments, Patrick Sharkey. We're going to talk about why and what that means for society. And I bet you might have guessed, we have some questions for our audience.
We do.
Are we becoming a country of homebodies? Are you going out less than you used to? If so, why? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or you can email from your home, studio2 at whyy.org.
Yeah, so such an interesting topic, and I thought about it, Avi. I am a social butterfly. You know this about me. But I still do spend a little bit more time at home. It's just the nature of the beast.
For you, that is shocking.
That is shocking. I know. Yeah. I know, but it's true. And we'll talk. I fall into some of the categories of what we're going to talk about later today.
I have a question.
Yeah.
What song do you think producer Paige has picked for our closing song today? Because there's a lot of possibilities with home. You know,
yeah.
You could do Our House. You could do...
Very, 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 very.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that would be a good one. Maybe there's a song called Home by Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros. So we'll see. I'm excited to see what producer Paige has lined up for us in the final set.
Do people get the email in about this with their guesses?
I don't think
we're going to
do the email.
Somebody might.
I think we're going to do the email thing tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
We'll do that tomorrow.
Let's keep it straight. All right. Well, we have to do our news. We have a trio of news stories we're going to talk about to kick it off. And the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, has reached a settlement in that case involving the 2019 refinery explosion and fire that rocked South Philadelphia. You remember that?
Yeah. I do, sadly.
Hard to forget, yeah.
The footage was stunning.
Yes, yes, yes. Philadelphia Energy Solutions, they've tentatively agreed to pay $4.2 million. That's a record settlement, the largest ever sought, for a violation of a provision of the Clean Air Act that requires that refinery owners and operators safely and properly manage regulated and extremely hazardous materials.
Now, $4.2 million.
$4.2 million. Biggest ever. Yeah.
Wow.
And if you remember, I mean, the PES refinery located near Girard Point and in Point Breeze, it was a very densely populated area. And the EPA says if you're going to have a facility like that in a neighborhood, you have to be diligent. And the agency found that the company had failed to identify hazards and problems in a pipe that corroded and caused this explosion and fire. And if you remember, they went bankrupt because after this explosion.
Yeah, there is no refinery anymore.
Yeah, and the refinery, it was 150 years old at the time, and it had been one of the largest oil refineries on the East Coast. It processed about 335,000 barrels of crude oil a day before this explosion. So this was a major loss. It's now owned, of course, by...
Hilco,
yeah, and they're turning it into the Bellwether District, which is going to have 54 buildings and all of this. But it's a pretty big deal. It's a pretty big settlement.
$4.2 million.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what to make of that number. They say it's the highest ever.
It doesn't sound like a lot when you think of what happened, but apparently for this provision, it's the largest ever secured. Yeah.
I guess what matters is whether or not $4.2 million acts as a deterrent for the next refinery operator. And I don't know that, you know, but if it does, then I guess it does its job. Let's transition now to a story that I guess in some ways is related to our topic today. Let me see if I can get there. So we're talking about hanging out at home. Mm-hmm. A lot of people on their computer, social media, posting whatever.
Yeah.
One of those
posting.
One of those thumbs. One of those What'd you say?
With the thumbs, you know. On your phone, just typing and posting. Go ahead.
One of those people posting whatever was a judge in Philadelphia's Common Pleas Court named Mark B. Cohen. He was elected to the Common Pleas Court in 2017. Remember, judgeships are elected here.
Yes.
In the state of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And a disciplinary court recently found that several of his Facebook posts violated rules around judicial impartiality because they were explicitly political. I will read one to you. This is a Facebook post by this now barred judge, Mark Cohen, about former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, and it is in the poetic styling of the book Good Night Moon. Mm-hmm. Cohen posted, quote, "Good night, Kevin McCarthy. Good night, Moon. No matter how long Kevin talks, we'll have passage of Build Back Better soon," which was a Biden initiative, you know, slogan, obviously.
Yeah.
So Cohen said on Facebook, ironically enough, that he will,
on there.
He will appeal this decision. And he told the Inquirer that this decision is a violation of his free speech principles. But apparently he posted too much and now he is a judge no more.
Wow. So interesting to me because, Avi, as a reporter, I would do these stories on the judicial races and very few people would pay attention. I even moderated a judicial forum before, 30 judges on these different panels, less than 30 people in the room.
Wow.
To hear it. So most people, you know, ignore them. And what was also interesting is the Philadelphia Bar Association does extensive background checks on judicial candidates, and he was on their list of candidates not recommended for office.
Oh, wow.
And of course, no one really checks this out. People go into the voting booth. They kind of pick if whatever party they are, they just pick all the judges because of a party, whether they're Democrat or Republican, with very little insight on who these individuals are, in large part because there's so many of them, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you don't know anybody's background. And all I'm saying is that we ought to pay attention because you don't know who's going to be on the other side of a bench if you end up before a judge. And
that
you
might
hope,
be your judge.
And you just hope whoever is wearing that robe is fair and impartial.
I totally understand why this is a rule,
mm-hmm.
why you don't want judges posting stuff like this on Facebook. But it's a little farcical. Because, like, let's take the case of Mark Cohen.
Uh-huh.
Before he was a judge, he was in the Pennsylvania State House as a Democrat for 42 years.
Yes.
You run as a Democrat, right?
And obviously.
Through the Democratic primary, correct? Am I right about this?
Yes, you are absolutely. And because there's judicial elections, there's a lot of partiality. People are running under a party banner.
In addition, his dad, David Cohen, was a longtime city councilman. As a Democrat. So it's not it's almost like don't say it out loud. But we know, obviously, you are a Democrat and you hold left leaning beliefs. It's just a funny juxtaposition.
But there has to be this appearance. You know, there shouldn't be an appearance of impropriety or an appearance.
I feel like the appearance is already there.
It is there.
You were in Harrisburg for 42 years
and
as a Democrat.
And we can get into a whole debate about whether or not judges should be elected. We could talk about that. But,
I get the rule. It's just a little funny to me when you think about the context around this one case. Okay, before we get out of here, let's totally shift gears and let's go down to Delaware.
We're going to chug on down to Delaware.
We're chugging?
Yes. Okay. Chug along. Folks in Delaware,
I'm not in Delaware yet. Just let me get there. I'm there.
It's a 30-minute ride. Yes. Folks in Delaware, they're trying a new tactic to save historic sites. They're bringing in ghost hunters.
Ghost hunters.
Yes.
Okay.
Diamond State ghost investigators are in their 16th year of using motion sensors, audio recorders, and infrared cameras to catch ghosts in motion. Although they don't necessarily guarantee this paranormal experience, they always say you never know what paranormal activity could happen. And
they're looking for ghosts in old historic sites in Delaware.
In Delaware, yeah.
That's
and
cool.
Like Fort Delaware and for the Lewis Historical Society.
It's Lewis,
by
the way.
Lewis.
I know it looks like Lewis.
Yeah, Lewis.
That's a big thing for people
Society.
In Delaware. You got to
say
Lewis.
Yeah, I got to say that right. And you know, folks are coming through. And I don't know, if you drive down 95, you see all the billboards.
For the
ghost stuff. And Delaware has a lot of that. I think it's really cool. I'm probably going to go to one.
Do you think they have more ghosts per capita in Delaware?
Probably not.
Yeah. Oh, probably not?
I don't know. Well, I mean, there's a lot of history there.
Apparently, according to Delaware Online.
They do?
These ghosts? No, the ghost tours are very popular there.
Yes, but I think it's because it's dark. When it gets dark there, some of these sites, it gets spooky. It feels spooky.
I really want to go to Fort Delaware, not for the ghost tour, but I've heard it's very cool. It's in the middle of the Delaware River, Cherry. How cool is that?
And I love stuff like this. I mean, I love adventures. You know, I love...
Haunted houses.
I love haunted houses,
it's
all that kind
of
stuff. Yeah, but even though I don't get scared at haunted houses, I still love to participate.
I do get scared, and I hate haunted houses.
You do? You don't like scary stuff?
So bizarre to me that people want to feel scared, that they watch scary movies, that they go to places where the whole point is to, like, jolt their nervous system. It makes no sense to me, but I don't judge people for it, obviously. I'm in the minority here, yes.
I like this little music coming up.
Oh, sure. It's Ghostbusters. Wow.
Love it. By the way, they're raising, when you go to these tours, they do raise money.
For the historic sites.
That's
nice. Thank you, Ghosts.
Yeah.
All right. Coming up, we're talking about Americans and their homes and why we're spending so much more time in them. If you have thoughts on this topic, email us, studio2@whyy.org.
The candidates for November are set.
Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
When you have kids, you have to go out. We go out all the time because, you know, if we're not at baseball practice, we're at dance or soccer or whatever the case may be. And then there are all the events you have to go to. So I think kids drive you out of the house more than anything else.
Yeah, nobody wants to drive, but I can go out, like, with them, go meet them at a house or, like, you know, one of our restaurants close by.
You know what? Since COVID, a lot of my friends have changed. They like to stay in. And then working, they get to work from home, depending on what they do, so... Yeah.
This is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aarons.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. And you just heard from Billy, a South Jersey farmer, Julie from the Philadelphia suburbs, and Dwight from Philly. And this brings us to our big question today. And let me start with you, Avi. Are you a homebody?
I'm with Billy, the South Jersey farmer.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know I had a lot of common cause with farmers, but I have the exact same experiences. Once you have a little kid, especially, they don't want to stay in the house. Like, my kid doesn't watch Netflix. So, like, yeah, I go home and she's like, let's go to the park.
Wow.
So we're out all the time. It's not always social, but we're out constantly.
We're out and about.
Yeah.
Well, it can be hard to get up that energy to go out after a long day at work.
That's still true.
Yeah.
That is still true.
Yeah.
I don't have the energy, but I do it.
But you still do it. You do it for the baby, yes. But people have a hard time getting that energy to volunteer at the local community center. The pull of the couch and Netflix is very hard to resist. And it turns out Americans are spending more time at home than in past decades. And this is a trend that started well before the pandemic. And while we all need downtime, there are some concerning implications associated with this rise in home time, including an increase in loneliness and a decline in civic engagement.
So why are we spending more time at home? And what does that mean for our social and emotional lives? We have two great guests joining us this hour. Patrick Sharkey is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. He recently published a journal article looking at the rise in time spent at home, and it inspired this very discussion. Patrick Sharkey, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And with us in studio, we have Mark Schultz, a psychology professor at Bryn Mawr College, and associate director of the Harvard Study of Adult Development. More on that later. He's also the co-author of a book, The Good Life, Lessons from the World's Longest Scientific Study of Happiness. Mark Schultz, so glad to have you with us in Studio 2.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
And to our audience, do you find yourself spending more time at home? Does it worry you? You can email us, studio2@whyy.org, or call 888-477-9499.
Well, Sharon on Facebook says, I love the peace of being at home. I'm very comfortable. I have everything I need.
Let's use
that as a jumping off point. Patrick Sharkey, first, can you tell us about this data in your new study and what you see as the big takeaway?
Sure. Yeah. So I did an analysis, and this is for the country as a whole. You know, so everything that I'm going to say is
is about all American adults, but there is important variation across different groups. And so what I did is I looked at how over the past 19 years, how has the proportion of our time spent at home changed? And this was really driven by a set of assumptions or a hunch that I had that the role of the home has seems like it has grown and across multiple dimensions. So I wanted to see post-COVID how our relationship with our home has changed, how the setting of our lives has changed over time. And the core finding, I'll just start there, is that over this period, American adults now spend about an hour and 40 minutes more time at home than they did back at the turn of the century in 2003. It's a shift from, we used to spend about 16 and a half hours at home each day on a typical day. And in 2022, it was just over 18 hours per day. You know, so that's a starting point. Then it leads us into a bunch of discussions about what it means for our relationships. And I'm glad we have Professor Schultz here as well to help out with those questions.
Yeah, and what's interesting, or what I found maybe most interesting about the study, is that time spent at home was rising in a roughly linear way from the mid-2000s all the way through 2019. That's a quote from your study. And so that's before the pandemic, right? 2019. Mm-hmm. It was already on the rise in a linear way. That's pretty explosive growth even before the pandemic. What do you take away from that, Patrick Sharkey?
Yeah, so this trend became very visible, glaringly visible during the pandemic when we were all kind of forced to rediscover the home and set up our home offices and in March 2020. But what I found is that this trend, really the pandemic should be seen as kind of an acceleration of a longer term trend. So for the past two decades, there was this steady increase in the percentage of time Americans were spending at home. And then that accelerated at a sharp pace during the pandemic, obviously, and hasn't returned to pre-pandemic levels. But it also tells us something, you know, like the shift to remote work is probably the most visible manifestation of this. And what I found is that was actually kind of a lagging indicator, meaning the changes in the workplace have kind of come after a whole set of other changes in life, where schooling has become more likely to take place at home, and socializing and eating and even like religious activity is more likely to take place at home. So the pandemic really shed light on a trend that had already been happening for the past two decades.
Yeah, I want to read this comment from Monique, who says on Facebook, "I'm a homebody, but it has gotten worse since COVID." That's what she says. And so I want you to dig into some of the demographic differences you found during your study. When you look at this rise in time spent at home, what's the differences between race, gender, or socioeconomic status? What'd you find?
There's some interesting differences, some interesting variation there. So first off, we find that virtually every group is spending much more time at home, and yet there's variation. So young people in this study, it's you know, 15 to 34 year olds have had the sharpest increase in time spent at home. And this is the group that, you know, on average spends the least amount of time at home, but the changes that have taken place over the past couple of decades have been most substantial for this group of young American adults. Across racial and ethnic groups, again, every group has now spends more time at home. One of the interesting findings, and this is a little bit tentative because the sample is relatively small, but Asian Americans have actually had by far the largest increases in time spent at home. And so this is really concerning, given that we know there was a rise in hate crimes directed toward Asian Americans. This was a troubling finding, and we need more research, but that was one that really stood out to me as well.
One thing that stood out to me in some of the work and just reading to prepare for this is that low-income and unmarried men have spent more time alone than almost any other group. Can you comment on the gender differences and this rise in time at home?
Yeah, so there are gender differences. The income differences are also interesting. It's actually, if we look at all adults, it's higher income adults who have had a greater change over time. Wow. But you're exactly right, Cherry, that there are these differences where low-income men, particularly, you know, whether they're working or not working, are more likely to spend time at home. And so, you know, that relates to this broader question about the degree to which this is intertwined with changes in our relationships, changes in our friendships and social networks, which I know we're going to get into in the course of this discussion. But there's a lot wrapped into this trend. You know, it's about how we interact with each other, but also how we interact with the institutions of social life, everything from churches to, you know, union halls to our schools and workplaces. Those interactions have really changed as the setting for social life has shifted over time.
That's the voice of Patrick Sharkey, professor at Princeton University, and he has this fascinating new study showing just how much more time Americans mm-hmm. are spending at home these days. With us in studio is Mark Schultz from Bryn Mawr College. And Mark, so time spent at home does not necessarily mean time spent alone, but when you see these data, what types of questions start going through your head? What more do you want to know? Yeah. So this is descriptive data. It tells us what people are doing. It doesn't, you know, we still want to know the effect of this. We want to know what it means for people's social and emotional lives. What types of questions start going through your head?
Yeah. So really interesting data and great study. And I think there are kind of two sets of questions that I think of right away. One is the why, what's leading mm-hmm. people to spend more time alone at home. And we can talk about that, and we have some ideas about some of the reasons. And then, of course, the questions about the consequences. So Patrick alluded to the idea that we need to think about people's social connections. If they're home, particularly if they're home alone, does that have consequences for their connections? Because we know that connections are important to people's physical health and their emotional health as well. So this is a big demographic shift, and I think those are the two big sets of questions that come to mind for me.
So why? I mean, I assume everyone mm-hmm. listening at home is thinking, why? Maybe mm-hmm. they have their own theories. And by the way, share them with us, studio2@whyy.org, or give us a call, 888-477-9499. Mark Schultz, let's try to start to answer that why yeah. question.
So I think, obviously, it's probably the combination of lots of things going on, but we can probably divide them up into two kind of bins. One is the kind of the pulling people into their homes. So people are talking about the home as a retreat, as a place that they are protected and safe, and it's a, you know, a tranquil place. So those are pulls. Those are nice things about being home. But there are pushes, too. So the pandemic was a big push there. It warned us that the world is not a safe place. We had to be separate and apart from other people. I think people see the home as a way to get away from some of the hassles of daily life. And I think that that may be true, but it also has other consequences as well. So I think it's that combination of push and pull. Technology is an important piece of this. So we can do things not in direct contact with other people. We don't have to be in real-time connections with people because of the technologies that have enabled us to do things virtually. And they're very powerful. They bring all sorts of advantages, allowing us to work remotely and to stay in contact with people during the pandemic. But it's also different than real in-person connections. So it's clear from our own research and from the research of others, when we talk to people over video-mediated communications, that it doesn't feel quite the same as in-person. It feels less close. There's less emotion expressed. Some people at work say that's great because emotion gets in the way. But emotion brings us together, right? It's what connects us. And it's also less of that reciprocal body language that we have when we talk to people. So there's something about just seeing the squares of people's upper bodies and their faces that limits our connection in important ways. That's what people tell us when they have those kinds of connections. So I think that shift is important. It's clear to me that part of the attraction is the flexibility and freedom you get. You don't have to do commutes. And if you have young children or older parents you're helping take care of, they're great
advantages.
And
you might spend more time with your family. Yeah. Like, there could be some upside to that there.
You might, absolutely. But we're also spending a lot of time on our screens as well.
I want to ask about the change in location of just mm-hmm. what we do. And I ask this because I used to go to the gym. I used to have a spin club that I was part of. Now I own a Peloton, right? Yeah. So how have things, how have you seen that shift? And has that been a factor, a major factor, in why people just spend more time at home?
I think that's a lovely example, right? So, you know, Peloton has created a kind of ecosphere where you can have some of the same connections you had from your spin class, but it's different because at the beginning of spin class, you're running into people and you'd say hi to them. At the end of spin class, you'd all be exhausted and sweaty and you'd share that experience in some way. It's harder to do that in these virtual ways that we connect. I think there are ways to do it. We have to get more creative. But when Zoom meetings start and end with the business part of our work, it makes it very hard to have those informal connections. But technology has enabled us in all sorts of ways. I love this example in the kind of leisure realm. It's allowed us to be home more, but in some ways it may also be having an impact on our connections with others.
Yeah.
Let me read this email from Sean, who says, I've been spending more time at home for sure. It used to be so much more affordable to go to concerts and events. Every outing now feels like it costs $30 to $50. As a gig worker, I see a decline in attendance. It's hurting the arts and music community. That's Sean's perspective. Share yours, studio2@whyy.org. Patrick Sharkey, I want to go back to you now and do a little history, because your study talks about what you found, but you also do an interesting overview of the historical inquiries into this topic. So what do we know about what was already happening over the course of, say, the 20th century when it comes to people's relationships with their homes, how much time they were spending in them, how that affected them? What did you find when you looked into that, Patrick Sharkey?
Yeah, so there is this tradition of kind of social scientists taking on the concern that the social fabric of society is fraying, and our connections to each other are changing, or our connections to kind of the civic society, the institutions of collective life. And I think, you know, most people have heard of Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone. This is kind of the one of the most prominent contributions to this literature. So this is a longstanding concern, and it has come in very different forms. One of the interesting things is that, you know, there was a real focus few decades ago, like in the late 1980s and early 1990s, on what was thought of as social isolation among the most disadvantaged segments of the population. So residents of communities where poverty was concentrated, where there might not have been access to the mainstream jobs or opportunities in the labor force. And this was kind of the central focus a few decades ago. I find it interesting that moving forward, some of the most substantial changes have come among more advantaged segments of the population. People with higher income are more likely to be staying at home now, to kind of retreat from collective life, retreat from the organizations that bring us together. And I mean, you know, again, everything from unions to libraries to even parks and playgrounds and public transit systems, all these kind of parts of public life that are designed to bring us together, to get us somewhere collectively, have faded a little bit in terms of their quality or in terms of their usage. And I think your audience member's comment kind of reflects that shift. So that's one of the fundamental changes, is that there aren't as many organizations that actually ask us to come out, to join together, to be a part of a group, and to be there physically as we interact with our peers or our colleagues or our friends. I think that's a fundamental shift in kind of how the meaning of social isolation has changed over time.
Yeah, and to our audience, do you find yourself spending more time at home? Does it worry you? You can email us, studio2@whyy.org, or call 888-477-9499. I want to talk about to you, Mark. I want you to kind of talk about some of what we get from socializing, from being in community. And Patrick mentioned Putnam's research, and he has discussed some of these positive aspects. Can you just give us an understanding of why this in-person community is so vital?
So I think it's sort of extraordinary when we take the moment to just step back and think about what it is that we get from connections to others. So there's so many things we get. We get a sense of the world being larger than just ourselves. So when we're alone, we might just worry about all the things going on in our head. And being with other people and connected to other things gets us out of our head and thinking about broader topics and issues. It's clear from research on people's social networks that larger networks, particularly the people on the periphery of those networks, teach us new things. We're able to learn from them. They may have different opinions, different ways of thinking, different ways of living. And that exposure allows us in some ways to be more creative if we're able to access those folks on the periphery of our networks. Harder to do when we're at home. Not impossible, but harder to do when we're at home. So connections help us in the moment. They buoy us. They help us, you know, cope with stress or challenge in our lives. They enable us to have a larger worldview. And I think most importantly, they remind us that we're human in some ways, that it's not just about what I'm experiencing in the moment. So walking around neighborhoods, for example, is an important experience for many people, certainly traditionally, saying hello to neighbors, seeing the person delivering your mail, acknowledging those folks, having, even if it's a small talk conversation, tends to energize people in ways that I think we've grown to dismiss or not to fully recognize how powerful that can be. It also brings us together when we have different ideas, right? That's part of, I talked about the push and pull. One of the reasons people are retreating is that conversations have gotten complicated. We hold very strong views and they're fraught.
Yep.
And maybe it's easier just to avoid and to stay home. But we give up something, right? We give up the opportunity to understand another person's perspective, to grow in our own opinions. So that's one of the challenges we face that I think pushes people into their homes.
And I had a quick follow-up question to Patrick, because you started to explore some of the erosion of some of these social structures, some of our organizations. Are there reasons for that? And I'm thinking of, you know, growing up, spent a lot of time in church, do that a lot less. Kids do that a lot less now. People may not have realized how much social interaction you get from that experience. Can you talk about some of the things that withered away and why?
Yeah, I think it's a hugely important aspect of this. And, you know, we can point to changes in technology, and those are, you know, obvious starting points for what allows us to spend more time. But then we also have to think about what else has changed in society. And Mark started to get at this in his comments earlier a bit. But, you know, first off, we live in a country that provides massive subsidies through tax policy to encourage people to buy the most expensive homes in the most exclusive neighborhoods, and then to do whatever they can to prevent development and exclude others. So that's been a trend that I think has really accelerated over the past 50 years or so. You know, this is a longer term trend, but we have never made the same commitments to what my colleague of mine, sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, calls social infrastructure, the investments in the institutions that bring us together. Mm. And this can be everything from churches, to libraries, as I mentioned earlier. So this leaves us in a position where I think, you know, being out in public spaces is sometimes unpleasant and difficult. I love New York City. I lived there for 10 years, but it wears on you after a while, those crowded subways when the train's late, you know, and it's 98 degrees as you're waiting for it. You know, traffic is worsening. Our train systems are a bit of a mess relative to much of the developed world. So, you know, instead of coming together in the United States, we have a big set of incentives that are really designed to help us separate ourselves from those problems that we see out there in the world. And that's really my biggest concern, or one of my biggest concerns, is that this trend is capturing something about our inability to invest and really make a commitment to the collective, to those spaces and those institutions that bring us together, help us solve problems, but also just contribute to our well-being, to our ability to understand each other. That's a central concern of mine.
Plus, in New York City, you got to deal with Mets fans, and that's a big issue as well. But I want to read this email now from Roxanne, who says, I believe Americans are staying home because there is easy access to food delivery services and entertainment via smartphones. We have Netflix, other streaming devices, programs, podcasts. I guess we're part of the problem there, which makes going outdoors less of a necessity. And that was where my brain went first, Mark Schultz, that it's really about this explosion of technology. That said, Patrick talked about other potential explanations, how our government invests, including, and this was fascinating from Patrick Sharkey's study, a quote, an alternative hypothesis is that increases in the size of homes in many parts of the U.S. may help explain why Americans are more comfortable spending time at home. So, Mark Schultz, let's talk about some other potential explanations as we come up on this break. Urbanization and suburbanization, just the change in the physical spaces in which we live. Do you think that's really potentially contributing to the trend?
I think for sure that's a part of it. So it's clear that houses have become bigger. There's more space. This trend in working remotely came at the same time that people are finding themselves in those spaces. Important, obviously, to recognize this is not true across all levels of, you know, socioeconomic levels. So people have different opportunities or different privileges when it comes to that. But homes have gotten bigger. Those spaces have gotten bigger. I think another piece that we should talk about, Patrick talked about the pandemic as a kind of accelerant in these trends. And the data are very clear. I totally agree with that perspective that they were happening long before the pandemic, these trends. But they got accelerated. There's another piece of it, though. We all learned things in the intense period of the pandemic about the possibility of being infected by being exposed to other people. People became vectors of disease. Yeah. There were things to avoid. Particularly young people, people who are teenagers during the pandemic, were isolated from their peers, had to be very careful for their own health. But all people across all ages, it's hard to come out of that pandemic. Those are important learning years, more important for young people because they're probably critical periods of development and learning how to connect to others. Mm-hmm. So there's a hangover from the accelerating aspects of the pandemic as well. People, I work in university, people still joke about we're still learning exactly how to be with each other. Yeah. So I think the pandemic combined with fraught politics and social issues have made people cautious about engaging with others. And I think that's important as well.
Yeah. And coming up, we're about to go to a break, but we're going to talk about the implications of this, the impact of this on young people, all the groups of us becoming more homebodies. So as we take this short break, we're asking, are we becoming a country of homebodies? Are you going out less than you used to? If so, why? You can email studio2@whyy.org or call 888-477-9499. We're here with Mark Schultz and Patrick Sharkey, and we here at Studio 2 will be right back.
The candidates for November are set.
Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Welcome on back into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and we are talking this hour about why Americans are spending more time at home. A new study by one of our guests, Princeton professor Patrick Sharkey, found that Americans are spending, and get this, an average of an hour and 39 minutes more at home than they did two decades ago. Bryn Mawr psychology professor Mark Schultz is also with us. He's associate director of the Harvard Study of Adult Development and the co-author of the book, The Good Life, Lessons from the World's Longest Scientific Study of Happiness.
And do you find yourself spending more time at home? Do you find it is hard to motivate yourself? Or how about this, to motivate your friends to go out and get involved in activities and groups? You can email us your thoughts at studio2@whyy.org or call 888-477-9499.
We teased this before the break, the idea of talking about how this impacts society writ large. But I still, before we get there, want to acknowledge a little pushback from our listeners. So Anne in Bryn Mawr asks, why are we stigmatizing homebodies? Ah. It's not necessarily a bad thing. And somewhat relatedly, Sandy says, has the research explored differences in what is isolation with introverts and extroverts? As an introvert, I do relish alone time, but as a musician, there are plenty of places to interact with others in jam sessions. That's Sandy's perspective. So, Mark Schultz, let me put that to you. The idea, because we are doing a little shorthand sort of association here, talking about time alone and social, time at home and social isolation, and kind of conflating them a little bit here. So maybe we should tease them apart a bit before we go any further in this conversation.
Yeah. So the way I like to think about this is that we can feel quite alone even in a crowd. You can feel alone in a good marriage. You can feel alone. College students today have some of the highest rates of loneliness among any demographic group. They're with thousands of other people with similar interests and activities. So we want to distinguish between physical isolation and a sense that we're lonely. And what that means is that we don't think anyone really cares about us or has our back or is interested in who we are. We kind of feel invisible. So we can feel that at home. We can feel that in a crowd. And I think that's the important distinction. I always think, you know, the word homebody does have a kind of pejorative tone in our society today. There are wonderful things about being alone. And it is true that introverts value that time more than extroverts. They value that time to recover from connections with others or just to be calm. So I think really important to recognize that. Some alone time is critical, but it's the experience of loneliness. And rates of loneliness have skyrocketed in most Western countries. In the U.S., depending on the survey, anywhere between a fifth and half of the population reports being lonely in a given week. Those are very high rates, and they have serious consequences. It's a very high risk factor for physical disease and also for premature death. So we need to pay attention.
Let's talk about consequences, and let me get into your research here. So you're associate director of the Harvard study. That's a longitudinal study that followed, make sure I have this right, two cohorts of men, one from Harvard, another cohort from inner city Boston, right?
Correct, yeah.
And you followed them over a long period of time. And one of your main findings, from what I understand, is that relationships matter maybe more than anything else. Yeah. So explain your findings and how they, you know, how they tie to what we're talking about today.
So, you know, we kind of step back. This is a study that's gone on for 86 years, and there was a kind of clear signal here in all of the data, the hundreds of papers. Our book was the 17th book written about the study. And it's what you said, Avi. It's that relationships keep us both healthier and happier throughout the lifespan. It's all relationships. So it could be a primary relationship, an intimate one. It could be a friendship. It could be your sister or cousins, neighbors, the people you work with. They're all important in keeping us happy and healthy. And I think the evidence, our study is, you know, originally 724 participants. We now study 1,300 of the children of the original participants. But in our book, we went well beyond that to look at thousands of other studies. And it's pretty clear these days that relationships have a connection to our physical health and our longevity as well. So if we're physically isolated and feeling lonely because of this demographic trend, it's really something we need to think about and to look at quite seriously.
And a quick follow-up for that before I bring in a caller. Are there folks who actually do thrive in alone? Is there a segment of the population that does that?
So the way I like to think about it is that connection to others is kind of like food. We all need it. Yeah, it's just that we have different preferences, right? Some of us like spicy food, some of us don't. So introverts tend to thrive when they have one or two close connections and they have more time alone, again, to recover from what can be the kind of work of being in a connection with others. But all of us need connection to others, even people who are physically isolated probably feel connected in important ways to others. So really critical for us.
Yeah, I want to read this comment from Ted from Philly, who says he had enough homebody time during the pandemic and he is still trying to make up for some missed time outside.
Yeah,
and now I want to bring in a caller, Rajendra from New Jersey. Rajendra, welcome to Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment was, I was listening to what the presenters were saying about, you know, my point was that I think we are only focusing on the U.S. and we are trying to generalize about the human race. But my point was, if you look at some of the Scandinavian countries, I think they go through the same technology. They have gone through the same experience. They are experiencing everything else. But somehow my belief is that we have taken public out of our public policy and they haven't. And I think that's what the major difference is between us and others.
So Rajendra is talking about the difference between us and Scandinavian countries. And I feel like you did allude to that earlier, Patrick Sharkey, the idea that we have to invest in public infrastructure that brings people out of their homes instead of simply incentivizing people to buy the biggest, comfiest homes possible. Do you see some connection between what you said earlier and what Rajendra just brought up about Scandinavian countries?
Yeah, I think it's a really important point and well stated there. This is not a universal trend. You know, I don't think we have data to know exactly where this is happening and where it's not. But this study is purely focused on the U.S. And I think the caller's point is really important here. There are a whole set of ways in which American social policy has provided very strong incentives. And I'll just give you one. You know, our largest housing policy by a wide margin has been the mortgage interest deduction for the past, you know, several decades. So this is a deduction that really provides a very strong incentive mm-hmm. for American home buyers to purchase, to go as deep into debt to buy an exclusive home and also to protect their home values, mm-hmm. you know, because such a large share of our assets and our debt are bound up in our homes. So this is one of those policies. This is a choice. You know, this is how we spend federal dollars on housing. This is much, it dwarfs any other housing policy we have in terms of just purely the expenditures that go to this tax deduction. And so what that means is that there are a set of incentives that encourage Americans to buy bigger homes, to spend more of their savings on homes, to go deeper into debt. But then secondly, to really protect their home and their larger neighborhood and town environment in ways that are not true anywhere near to the same extent in lots of countries in the developed world. So that's just one example of kind of investing in the private instead of, as a caller put it, in the public. Mm-hmm. When we think about public policy, I think it was a point beautifully made.
Yeah, and I want to read this email from Susan who says, I am experiencing the perfect storm. I recently retired from full-time work. Some of my activities, book club, poetry group, all moved to Zoom during the pandemic and decided to stay that way. DoorDash, Grubhub have made my favorite restaurant's food available for delivery. I used to do in-person activism, and now I do more writing of letters and postcards to promote voting rights and get out the vote. I want to ask about the carrots, because Patrick, and maybe you can even weigh in on this, Mark, what kind of carrots could organizations, could workplaces, could, you know, public organizations, agencies, the government put out there to get people to come out of their homes? And, you know, Mark, you're shaking your head. So maybe we'll start with you.
Yeah, I think there are lots of things that we can do. And part of it is providing real leadership. So we can't forget the importance of modeling at the top. So people in positions of leadership need to emphasize how important it is to connect, to understand, to treat people with respect. And that means when you have the opportunity to do that, you ask how people are doing. You ask about what their experience is. So that's really powerful. I think Patrick alluded to this idea of social infrastructure, that we need to build places where people want to be. So the debate we're having about remote work and hybrid work, part of the way I think eventually we're going to deal with it is we have to make workspaces where people want to come in. So my first reaction, actually, Cherry, when you were asking the question was, you know, food is kind of hard to replicate mm-hmm. virtually, right? So, you know, when we have meetings, I bring food to yeah. meetings as an incentive for people to come.
Pretzel day, pizza day.
Exactly.
That's always good. Yeah.
Exactly. And of course, we can get around it with remote meetings. You can deliver to everyone that pretzel these days. But there are easier ways to do this. And that's to enjoy being together, to have that opportunity to connect. And remember that meetings aren't only about transactions. All yeah. of our meetings are about joy and meaning and connection. So we need to sort of balance in our world. And I think this is an important cultural trend, wanting to have kind of maximal freedom, wanting to be free from obligations versus being part of a community or a collective. Those were the words that I think Patrick used early on, that there's that tension. And I think young people are feeling it and older people are feeling it these days about wanting to have that freedom and connecting and being with other people can feel like a responsibility yeah. sometimes.
Yeah.
I was going to say housing policy, transit policy, tax policy. You didn't think that was going to come up this hour, and yet it is all connected. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I wanted to ask Patrick. What type of public policy carrots can be, you know, sort of hung out there to lure people out of their houses and back into a community type setting?
Well, I think, you know, we can support the institutions that bring people together. And so that starts with the type of infrastructural investments that have been mentioned. You know, make it pleasant to be on the subway or on a bus to get to where you need to go.
Clean it up.
Yeah, basic investments, you know, it should be It should be pleasant to go out in the public space and to you know, we can make substantial progress in dealing with traffic, which has worsened for the past few decades, in making it possible for people to come together on trains, on transit systems, on buses. That's like a starting point. But, you know, the government can also play a role in supporting institutions that bring people together. You know, churches, religious congregations bring people together, and community centers, after school programs. Like, these are all parts of the social infrastructure. And if the United States policy were directed not towards subsidizing people to live in gated communities, you know, where they are their primary goal is to preserve their home values, but rather to invest in the kinds of institutions that allow people to come together to solve problems collectively. This is kind of the ideal of democracy, but I don't think it has translated into a public commitment in a way that might be true in much of Western Europe, for instance. Yeah.
Let me end with two emails. It's fascinating because they're almost like mirror opposites of each other. Max says, as someone who's never been on social media, I can tell you with precision that Facebook was one inflection point. Prior to social media, I talk with my friends a lot. Since then, it seems like they just post about their lives. Robert says, I happen to be listening to the show on the app, the WHYY app, revamped, by
the
way.
Thank you for that.
While walking my dog. Technology isn't a panacea by any means, but it's helped me get out of the house. Meetups, Discord servers, chats that help me keep up with my friend groups. And Robert then included a picture of his dog. Lena.
So cute, by the way.
I can't end the show any better than that. But I will thank our guests, Patrick Sharkey, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, recently published an article in Sociological Science, Homebound, The Long-Term Rise in Time Spent at Home Among U.S. Adults. Patrick, thanks so much for your insights.
Thank you both. Really good to be with you.
And we also heard from Mark Schultz, professor of psychology at Bryn Mawr College, associate director of the Harvard Study of Adult Development, also co-author of The Good Life, Lessons from the World's Longest Scientific Study of Happiness. Mark, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you. Really interesting discussion.
You hear that song?
I love it.
I guessed it.
You did.
This is our house.
I love it.
Producer Paige, I got you today.
Good stuff, producer Paige. And we got to mention about the Phillies.
Oh, yes. Phillies on the brink of elimination tonight against the New York Mets. Come on, Phils. Pull it out. Phillies radio announcer Kevin Stocker will be live with Mary Cummings Jordan at 1:20. Stay tuned for that.
Yes. And this wraps our show for today. Our show is produced by Debbie Bilder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin Bacori from Studio 2's house at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg. I sang this pretty good earlier, didn't I?
You did. You want to try it now?
I won't.
Okay.
I won't do it.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We will talk with you tomorrow.